From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn about Global Brigades, a nonprofit created by a Marquette grad that helps students understand poverty and help find solutions. Then we look at how the pandemic is impacting oral health.
Any patients who are really stressed, we can definitely see these signs of grinding and clenching on their tongue, on their teeth.
Bubbler Talk explores the history of Milwaukee's Borchardt Field and the famous athletes who played there. Plus, the documentary Disclosure looks at the history of transgender misrepresentation in media.
Until we live in a time that all is fair and equal, you have to prioritize people who have a stake in the game. People who have a stake in the game need to be telling the stories. Let us tell the stories before you tell them for us.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Today, we'll learn how the stress of the pandemic could be impacting your oral health. We'll hear from a healthcare worker who received the COVID-19 vaccine. The latest Bubbler Talk explores the history of Milwaukee's Borchardt Field. And we'll hear from the director of the Netflix documentary Disclosure. First, we'll learn about Global Brigade, a nonprofit created to put high school and college students to work, eradicating poverty around the world. There are more than 500 international chapters at high schools and universities, including UW-Milwaukee, Marquette, UW-Madison, and the Milwaukee School of Engineering. But like so many other things, their work has been impacted by the pandemic. Now, instead of visiting countries like Ghana, Nicaragua, and Panama, students are doing their work virtually. Sheethal Vora is the co-founder and CEO of Global Brigades. She founded the group in 2003 as an undergrad at Marquette. She spoke to WUWM's Mayon Silver about how the organization has adapted during the pandemic. Sheethal starts by explaining how a trip to Honduras sparked the idea for the organization.
Back in 2003, I had the opportunity to, you know, really come up with this idea with a couple of others. Back in my sophomore year at Marquette, I was really lamenting at the fact that I couldn't study abroad. It wasn't a part of something that I could do because I was in the physical therapy program there. And what was a part of the program is classes throughout every semester, including the summers. And, you know, again, that was something I really wanted to do in my college experience. I mentioned this to a friend, in a conversation that we had, and he, you know, had mentioned that his neighbor had done these trips to Honduras, and, you know, he thought that it would be a good idea to perhaps join along and have a mini study abroad type of experience with them. So 20 of us in 2003, we grabbed, you know, about 20 of our friends and on Marquette's campus, and we got on a plane and went to Honduras with a group of these physicians. And we thought we'd just be lugging medicine, and we thought we would just be translating, some of us that spoke Spanish. But what we didn't know is that we were able to, as undergrads, as aspiring young professionals, that we were able to make impact. We were completely shocked that we were able to make impact in these rural communities in just 1 week. So it was just a truly life-changing and transformational experience for me and everyone that went on that brigade. Returning home, we came back to campus to see if there were organizations that catered to undergraduates that allowed them to get involved in this capacity. And we researched options. And back then, there wasn't anything out there. There was Doctors Without Borders, but you had to be a licensed professional. And there was Peace Corps, but you had to commit a long, you know, commit long term. And that was something that we were unable to do as undergrads. So we decided to create our own organization. We, you know, learned very quickly and had some mentors in the Milwaukee area and decided to just take the leap of faith and start an organization to cater to undergraduate students, you know, this type of amazing transformational experience. Now, fast forward 18 years from that time, we're now the largest student-funded humanitarian organization that has over 500 university and high school chapters throughout the world. So before, students would, again, get on a plane, they would go to Latin America, to West Africa, to Greece, and be able to participate a 7 to 10 day experience in international medicine and international business and international water and sanitation type programs alongside with our community leaders. And they would return back and, you know, either go on another trip after that or be able to do some local or do some more volunteer type of experiences similar to what Global Brigades was providing. So that was how we operated before the pandemic had hit.
So you talk about a transformational experience. What's the average student's experience when they would go on these pre-pandemic Global Brigade 7 to 10 day trips?
Sure. So the transformational experience really comes about when you're being exposed to a whole different culture than where you're currently living, whether it's Milwaukee or Chicago or wherever. It's being able to connect with individuals in other cultures, so really having that cross-cultural experience, that cross-cultural integration. And then, you know, the most important part was being able to see how these resource-limited communities were very much in need of some support, right? There was a lot that they just didn't have, basic access to healthcare. There was no clean water. There were no banks or access to capital to be able to lift them out of poverty. And for as undergrads and as individuals that were really there to figure out sustainable solutions, and when I mean sustainable, long-term solutions for these communities, you know, that was what was transformational for us, is to be able to know that we had an opportunity to support these communities and help them and empower them to be in a better place based on resources that they currently had.
Eradicating poverty is a very noble but also extremely ambitious goal. What sort of accomplishments has the organization had so far?
So we have a variety of accomplishments. We've been around for, you know, almost over 15 and 16 years. And, you know, we've treated hundreds of thousands of patients. We've built hundreds of water systems or repaired hundreds of water systems throughout Latin America and West Africa to bring potable water into the communities. We've been able to establish hundreds of banks within these rural communities so that these community members have access to capital and be able to, you know, build their businesses or be able to, you know, get a loan or save their money in a way that is safe and in a way that is empowering to them. You know, there's been 15 years of tremendous impact that we've made in the community. I mean, over 300,000 to 400,000 beneficiaries.
So what has it been like adapting the Global Brigade to the pandemic?
Sure. So I'm going to talk a little bit about, you know, the organization itself, how we are set up in order to properly explain our pivot, if that's all right with you. So something that sets us apart, you know, being Global Brigades, being a really successful and ambitious, you know, humanitarian organization, is that we have a completely different model than many organizations. So what we're doing is we're not just simply going into a community and providing 1 week's of free doctor's visits or building a school. What we're doing is that we're making long-term commitments to our to these resource-limited communities around the world, and we're empowering them with sustainable solutions for many generations to come. And we do that through our holistic model. And our holistic model is really our multidisciplinary approach in addressing the needs in the community. So, you know, to be able to use a familiar analogy, we aren't just teaching the communities to fish. We're actually providing them with the boat and the rod to be able to fish long after we've left. And then taking that fishing analogy, you know, to the next level here is that, you know, what is Global Brigade's boat in this instance? And it's really based on three key elements. And these three key elements are access to healthcare, our clean water and hygiene solutions, and then again, access to capital. And really, you know, those three things make our holistic model work and really impact our communities to make them self-sustainable. And, you know, community empowerment is so essential to our success. So what that means is that community members are involved in every single step of the way. And two other, you know, components is we have full-time staff in each country that we work in. In order to fulfill these 2 to 5 year commitments that we have in our communities, there's hundreds of dedicated staff in these countries. And if we didn't have these staff members based in these countries, we would not have been able to pivot virtually. So going back to your question, you know, how have we pivoted with the pandemic? So our commitment to eradicating poverty couldn't lose momentum when COVID-19 hit. We were, you know, certainly as many organizations were, just had to process what was happening, but we were absolutely committed to seeing these commitments and seeing these programs through. So what we did was we quickly pivoted to a concept called telebrigades. And the pandemic pivot was really necessary because young people simply could no longer travel abroad to be able to garner these hands-on experiences. So how we do that is now Zoom, instead of formerly airplanes, are whisking these high school and the university students from their home desks out to Latin America, to West Africa, and to Greece in real time. So telebrigades for college students and telesquads, which is our program for high school students, are continuing to bring hope to these residents in the resource-limited communities while providing the students with hands-on leadership and career-building skills that they receive via virtual experiential learning. So the best part is that the students are completely immersed in these communities while they're, you know, at their desk in their remote learning environment.
And have you found that the needs of the people in the various countries that you serve and thus the priorities of Global Brigade have shifted since the pandemic?
Sure. So far, what we've learned is that the communities, the resource-limited communities that we partner with and that we work with, are needing the same things even during the pandemic, right? They're still needing the access to healthcare. They're still needing access to capital and clean water solutions. The other things that they need is just basic education about this pandemic so that they're able to be advocates of their own health. So that's something that we've also incorporated in some of our opportunities in our program methodologies.
And we talked a little bit about the impact that the program has been having on the communities that you serve and that they work hand in hand with students at every step of the way, is what you're saying. What do students tell you here in Wisconsin about their experiences with the program?
With the program, sure. So the telebrigades, we basically have three major components. We have our medical telebrigades, which really focuses on our pre-med, dental, physical therapy, nursing students, you know, anybody that is on that healthcare track. Our water telebrigades focuses a lot on engineering students and students that are really passionate about clean water. And our business telebrigades are focusing on supporting community-owned banks and consulting with small businesses. So those students that have participated in those programs have been able to really get immersed in the concepts of, you know, what these community members need, the building the skills of the community members and the capacity of the community members, while also building the capacity themselves. Some of these concepts are new for undergrads, and they're, you know, learning this through our staff and through our, you know, experts on the ground and through our educators to be able to learn and then be able to share some of those learnings with our community members.
And what can other people in Wisconsin do to help if they're interested, if they're not necessarily students, but they want to get involved somehow?
Absolutely. We've been having a lot of individuals from corporate settings be able to participate in a telebrigade. It's a great way to fulfill their CSR opportunities within a company. And then also our large donor base mostly comes from the Wisconsin area. And so we've been very fortunate to have many donors that are based in Milwaukee and the surrounding Wisconsin areas really supporting our mission because they know that the work that we do is just so tremendously important, not only for the communities that we support, but also to the impact that we make in leadership development for the students that are participating in our programs.
Sheetal Vora of Global Brigades, thank you for sharing a bit of information about your program with us.
Thank you so much. This was a pleasure.
Dr. Sheetal Vora is the co-founder of Global Brigades and a graduate of Marquette University. She spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver. Dr. Vora is the keynote speaker today at Marquette's annual Mission Week luncheon. For this week's Bubbler Talk, we take a trip back in time, before County Stadium, before Miller Park, or now American Family Field. We'll tell you all about Borchardt Field in Milwaukee and the famous athletes who played there.
Babe Ruth played there. He and his partner, Lou Gehrig, traveled around the country at the end of some seasons, and they played Ty Cobb. Red Grange, very famous football player.
More on Borchardt Field in about 15 minutes. But first, we'll learn how the stress of the pandemic is raging a war against our teeth and what we can do to help ease the pain. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. If you've been experiencing dental issues over the last year, you're not alone. Chipped teeth and jaw pain have become a major problem for many Americans during the pandemic. The cause? Most likely stress. Dr. Yasser Khalid is used to dealing with these issues. As a TMD orofacial pain specialist, he works with patients to ease issues like teeth grinding and clenching. He joins me now to talk about these issues and what you can do to help them. Dr. Khalid, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
My pleasure.
Anecdotally, I've heard from really a surprising number of people about a variety of different dental issues, specifically chipped teeth and jaw pain. As a dentist, have you been seeing this same trend?
Yes. So this is the type of patient that I actually see every day. And I can definitely confirm that we have been seeing much more patients in the last year as a result of the pandemic. So definitely the pandemic has increased the level of stress in the public. And the stress definitely does lead to TMD issues, also increases the rate of grinding and clenching habits in the patients. I would like to actually focus on one, what exactly causes TMD. It's mainly trauma, hormones, sleep disorders, and stress.
So that's my big question here. I think a lot of us have been, you know, connecting this to the variety of stressors that we've been experiencing during the pandemic. How does stress really impact your teeth?
So the stress actually leads mainly to more grinding and clenching habits. And I would like to clarify the difference between the grinding and the clenching. The grinding, or the bruxism, involves moving of the jaw with the teeth held together. This, of course, results in sustainable, visible wear and flattening of the teeth, which is, of course, obviously noticed by both the dentist and the patient. There is another parafunctional habit called clenching, which is simply holding the teeth together and tightening the jaw muscles. So any patients who are really stressed, we can definitely see these signs of grinding and clenching on their tongue, on their teeth, and definitely also has negative effects on the TMD. And it's very important to deal with not only TMD problems, but with all types of orofacial pain, with all types of stress management. This is very, very important for everyone to know, because most people, when they start having pain on their TMJ, they think it's an ear infection. So they go to the ENT specialist, or sometimes they go to a neurologist. So this is maybe one of the most important things that I wanted everyone to know about, that we do have something called orofacial pain and TMD specialty. And we are the only school of dentistry here in Wisconsin that provide this service here.
How does that lead to things like chipped teeth? Because that's one that I've heard quite a lot.
Yes. So when you start grinding and clenching, this by time will lead to chipping and sometimes even a fracture of some of the teeth, especially the incisors. And that's why we have lots of management techniques that we do here to try to help these patients with the grinding and clenching habits. So we have Botox shots that we give in the masticatory muscles. We also provide patients with night guards. These help a lot with the grinding and clenching habits, especially that happen overnight. We've also started, for the first time ever in the history of Marquette, a combined mutual clinic between us and the physical therapy clinic in Marquette. So we basically see patients together and treat them for all this grinding and clenching habits, both myself and Brent, who is a physical therapist in the physical therapy clinic in Marquette.
Interesting. So that sounds like essentially you're treating a number of the symptoms surrounding it physically, which then has an implication on your teeth.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if you're someone who already has a chipped tooth, especially, or has been experiencing really tight jaw pain, What should you do? Is there any issue with waiting to get it treated?
So definitely the sooner the better. We need to start treating these issues as soon as possible, because if you have a chipped tooth or if you have some TMJ problems, that by time might result in a locked jaw, which means that you might not be able to close or open your mouth anymore. Also, it can result in severe pain during opening your mouth. So that's why the earlier the better to start treating these symptoms as soon as possible. We always recommend our patients to start with stress management techniques. And we do all these stress management techniques and we give the patients handouts for these. As I said, also prescription of medications is one of the other things. So we do prescribe sometimes muscle relaxers, tricyclic antidepressants or anti-epileptic medications or non-steroidals. We've also just started also doing hypnosis here to treat TMD patients. So all these things together with, of course, a very important recommendation is avoiding caffeine and alcohol as much as you can, because this makes the TMD problems worse.
I think like a lot of people, I've been drinking a lot more caffeine during the pandemic.
Yes. And this is the problem, you know, when you get more stressed, you tend to drink more caffeine. And this actually takes you into a vicious cycle of making it much worse. So that's why we try to say, I'm not saying you should completely avoid the caffeine, but try to limit the number of coffee or tea cups per day. And as I said, stress management is number one. Everyone has to seek before things get out of control.
To take a bit of a turn, a lot of people, myself included, have been leery about going to the dentist during a pandemic, in part because, you know, your mouth is open the entire time. And of course, we're all wearing masks to limit the spread. What are the kinds of safety precautions that dentists like yourself have been taking?
So that's a very good question. And I actually, many patients ask me this question, is it safe for me to come to see you? And I can definitely confirm that specifically here at the School of Dentistry in Marquette, and I'm sure in most, if not all of the private practices out there, there is very, very strict safety requirements for any dentist to work in this pandemic. Starting with, of course, the basic masks, which we actually used to wear even before the pandemic. Now we are using special N95 masks. On top of that, we also use the face shield. And on top of that, there's also very thorough cleaning of the rooms after every single patient. So we take the safety of the patients very, very, very importantly here in Marquette University. We care about our patients. And that was number one thing that we had to do when we shut down last March, when the pandemic started. We opened back in May, but before we opened, we made sure that we had enough PPE for the students and for the faculty to start seeing patients very safely. And I can proudly say we've been working since last May until now, and we have not had any single case of COVID transfer inside the School of Dentistry. So we are very proud of that.
That's impressive during a pandemic.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Well, Dr. Khaled, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Sure, of course. My pleasure. Thank you so much. Yeah.
Dr. Yasser Khaled is a dentist specializing in TMD, orofacial pain, and he's an assistant professor in the Marquette School of Dentistry. Wisconsin's mask mandate is back in effect after Republican lawmakers briefly struck it down last week. Governor Tony Evers issued a health emergency order saying masks are necessary to avoid risking public health. Health officials say despite the vaccine rollout, people should still be taking precautions like wearing a mask, practicing physical distancing, and hand washing. About 10% of Wisconsin's population has received at least one dose of the vaccine so far. But demand remains high and the supply is limited. The government has prioritized vaccinating frontline workers and others in Phase 1A group, like Matt, who shares his perspective on receiving the COVID-19 vaccine.
My name is Matt, and I am a registered nurse. For me, there was no hesitation with getting the vaccine, as many of us are glued to our phones and the TV with COVID since the beginning, as all of the information was starting to come out about both the Pfizer and then the Moderna vaccine. I just really kept up on the articles and watched and read as much as I could. So knowing that it went through, you know, the full FDA process and the vetting process that it needs to, that all the other vaccines go through. Yes, it was at a quicker speed, but no, there was no doubt. I wanted to be kind of the first one to get it, even if I could. Really, I was lucky, or whatever you want to call it. I didn't have any real major side effects from the vaccine, either the first or the second dose. The most I could really say would be that I maybe felt a little bit tired the day after I got it, and my arm was maybe a little bit sore. But, you know, it wasn't any different for me in terms of how I was feeling than the annual flu shot. It's a really weird feeling because you've got that layer of protection now, but it also, being, you know, a healthcare worker and being kind of the first people to be getting the vaccine, it also gives you just this response, this feeling of responsibility too, because you want to put on Facebook and Instagram that you got the vaccine so that you can kind of show people that it is safe and people are out there getting it and they're doing okay with it. But, you know, getting it, it makes me feel good. But at the same time, this isn't over yet. You know, I'm still going to have to wear a mask. I'm still going to have to socially distance to protect everyone else. But it's definitely a weird feeling to kind of be done in the sense of getting both of the doses. I think the biggest advice is, you know, do what feels right for you and just do your research. And whether that is reading about it, whether it's watching, you know, I should say approved, you know, videos or articles, getting, you know, your hands on any of that information. You don't talk to your doctor. Talk to your friends. You know, if you don't have any maybe medical type friends or someone like that, you know, in your life, ask someone that might know someone. Because again, as being someone that was able to get this first dose, I almost feel like a steward to the vaccine in the sense that, you know, I want to talk about it. If people do have questions, that I can answer to the best of my ability, or then, you know, reference someone to somewhere that they can get that information that they need to. So I worked the clinic a couple times and it was a really great experience. It had been a while since I had worked really like technically a vaccine clinic. Honestly, it was probably in college, which was 10 years ago, that I worked like a full like vaccine clinic. But it was a really kind of incredible atmosphere, both in the people that were giving the vaccines, but just the kind of excitement to be a part of, you know, getting everybody, the world back on track in a sense, and getting that protection for, you know, our frontline workers who have done so much over almost the past year now at this point. It was just really exciting to be a part of it.
Matt is a registered nurse in Milwaukee who received the COVID-19 vaccine. To hear more testimonials from Wisconsinites who've received the vaccine, head to WUWM.com. There you can also find all of our coverage of the COVID-19 pandemic, including the latest information about the state's mask mandate. Coming up, we'll hear from the director of the Netflix documentary Disclosure, which explores transgender representation in media.
A beautiful story could be told about trans representation by non-trans people, but it wouldn't be the same as this. And I think you sense it. I think you feel it in the intimacy of the stories. I think you feel it in the way the narrative unfolds.
That's coming up in about 6 minutes. But first, the latest Bubbler Talk explores the history of Borchardt Field, Milwaukee's longest standing professional ballpark. That's next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge. Milwaukee is known for being a city of neighborhoods. From Bayview on the south side to Washington Heights to the west, each neighborhood has a story, including the Borchard Field neighborhood on the city's north side. The neighborhood got its name from the athletic field that spanned 8th Street to the west, 7th Street to the east, Chambers to the south, and Burleigh to the north. I-43 now runs through the middle of what used to be. I'm WUWM's LaToya Dennis, and for this week's installment of Bubbler Talk, I'm taking you back in time before County Stadium or Miller Park, now called American Family Field.
Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd.
The year was 1888, 2 decades before this famed song would be released. Milwaukeeans wanted a new athletic field before opening day for the Milwaukee Brewers of the Western Association.
It was built in 3 months.
That's Bob Beagie. And if you're asking questions about Borchard Field, he's the guy to talk to. He says around $40,000 was spent to build Borchard, and $35,000 of that was the cost of the land.
You can imagine it was a pretty simple ballpark. It was entirely of wood. It was a place that Milwaukeeans went to for a number of things besides baseball, but especially baseball.
Beagie says besides the minor league Milwaukee Brewers, the Green Bay Packers used to host games at Borchard, along with the lesser-known professional football team, the Milwaukee Badgers. He says almost every famous ball player from the 20th century took to Borchard Field.
Babe Ruth played there. He and his partner Lou Gehrig traveled around the country at the end of some seasons, and they played Ty Cobb. Red Grange, very famous football player. The Milwaukee Badgers had a team that played all the big stars in football. There was a game that was played in November of 1922 involving Paul Robeson.
Yes, that Paul Robeson, the iconic singer, actor, and civil rights leader. He played for the Milwaukee Badgers.
He was going to school at Columbia Law School in New York, and he would get on a train on Friday afternoon after his classes ended, and he'd ride overnight to Milwaukee, play a football game. He played this game against Jim Thorpe, the most outstanding athlete of the 20th century. Paul Robeson caught the only 2 touchdowns.
Milwaukee won that game 13-0. Beagie says the following year, in 1923, another baseball team called Borchard Field home, the Negro League Milwaukee Bears. He says there was one game that surely made people in the neighborhood, which was majority white at that time, uncomfortable.
A caravan of fans, all African American, I believe, came up from Chicago to watch a game that the Bears played. They had fancy cars, Duesenbergs or Futz Bearcat, and they parked along 8th Street with probably about 20 really impressive automobiles. And people must have wondered, first of all, who are all these people and where did they get these cars?
The Milwaukee Bears only lasted 1 season because the team ran out of money, but others continued to play at Borchard Field through 1952. County Stadium opened in 1953 as the Major League Boston Braves moved to Milwaukee. Beagie says the decision to move away from Borchard Field was easy because by that time it was a dump.
Because it was all wood, it would sometimes catch fire from abandoned cigarettes and cigars. So the owner would hire kids to go around with a bucket and put out fires that started in the stands.
Beagie says that when Borchard Field was being deconstructed, a sign was put up that read, "Free Kindling," and people from the community took the wood to heat their homes.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Sun Badger Solar. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit WUWM.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
You can hear Bubbler Talk every Monday on Lake Effect. If you missed last week's episode and you want to learn why we put soda in our old fashions here in Wisconsin, you can find the answer at WUWM.com. TV and film can be powerful mediums, especially for connecting people to lives or worlds different from their own. For transgender people and experiences, these representations have been historically damaging. Filmmaker Sam Fader's Netflix documentary Disclosure is an examination of the history of trans representation on screen. The film features prominent trans creators and thinkers and explores trans portrayals on screen through the lens of accountability and understanding. The film has just been nominated for Outstanding Documentary by the GLAAD Media Awards. Fader spoke to Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski when the film was released last summer. He begins by explaining the inspiration for Disclosure and the timing of its release.
It came out at an interesting time, in a time that people are so open-hearted, you know, and people want to learn and people want to know what they need to unlearn. So being able to contribute to this conversation is so meaningful and not lost on us at all. And what an honor that is. You know, it's a film that I feel like I've been thinking about for decades. You know, in 1987, I saw this film. I did not see it in 1987, but early on, I did see a film that came out in 1987 called Ethnic Notions. And that is a film made by Marlon Riggs, who passed in the early 90s. And it's a film about the representation of Black people in Hollywood. And then there was also a film called Celluloid Closet that came out in 1995. And that was about the representation of gay and lesbian people in film in Hollywood. And both of those films really kind of changed the way I understood our relationship to representation and media. And in Ethnic Notions in particular, I was changed by the way that the slightest shift of the lens, who you're centering in a story, completely changes how you understand history. I mean, Ethnic Notions is the history of America, right? And it's when the center of your story is not a white, cis, straight man, you're suddenly seeing an entirely different history. And so I was really struck by that and was curious for a really long time what that would look like for trans people. So that was something I've been thinking about for a long time, but then the timing seemed right when in 2014, 2015, we started to see this increase of visibility. And by that point, I'd been making documentaries about trans issues for about 10 years. And so it really made me question the utility of visibility, because what I was seeing, this excitement and this framing that this was a success story, that this was all we needed, that visibility is the goal of the trans movement. And there was also something that was really disconcerting around this public discourse, was that transness was somehow something new, right? That we were just kind of coming onto the scene. And so I really felt compelled to give more context to understand these changes and these conversations we were seeing. I felt like there was more to the story than what the public was seeing and talking about, and I wanted to tell that story.
Right, going beyond simply visibility, right?
Right, right. Visibility is not the goal, right? The goal is equality and liberation, and visibility is part of getting that to those places. Visibility is a means to the goal. It is not the goal in itself, and often visibility makes marginalized communities more vulnerable. And that is really, it's really necessary to reckon with that. I do not think there's a one-to-one relationship ever between like a violent image and a violent situation on the street, but I do think there is a dialogue between those two. And that really needs to be given the care and the nuance that it deserves. And I think, you know, we talk about that in depth at Disclosure by, you know, when you're seeing these images again and again, how does that inform you as a trans person or not as a trans person of what it means to be trans? And how does that inform you and give you the directions of how to navigate the world when you learn someone is trans? So there's a lot, you know, that I wanted to talk about and kind of spark dialogue around.
Well, and one thing that's just as important on screen as it is behind the screen and behind the scenes is the number of trans people who worked on this project. So of course, it's a personal thing you want to accomplish, but was this also an advantage of making an independent film and being able to prioritize who you have involved in this project?
Oh, you mean as opposed to being having to answer to execs?
To execs.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I've never been in the position to work with executives, so that's a funny way of like coming at that question. This film was made, you know, with a very small team. We spent probably 80% of our time fundraising. It was an uphill battle. And we we only interviewed trans people in front of the camera. And that was a no-brainer. And it was just as much of a no-brainer to me that everyone behind the camera be trans. And so we prioritized hiring trans people, and we couldn't hire a trans person on set. We mentored a trans person. right? So every key position on set was influenced by a trans person's life experience. And it's so important because there is such a specific experience when you have a stake in the game, right? When you have some risk in the story that really you cannot replicate unless it is your life experience. You know, a beautiful story could be told about trans representation by non-trans people, but it wouldn't be the same as this. And I think you sense it. I think you feel it in the intimacy of the stories. I think you feel it in the way the narrative unfolds. You know, my director of photography, Ava Benjamin Shore, trans woman, you know, there are certain subtleties that only she would be sensitive to, right? As a trans person behind the camera, kind of having a sensitivity to how a trans person might want to be framed, right? How does the lighting need to be specific? What kind of makeup needs to be specific? Like, these are things that you're just not going to be sensitive to. Like, I can't overstate it. So we got a lot of pushback on that early on because people would be like, oh, that's really nice. That's nice that you want to prioritize trans people, but don't you just want the best person for the role? It's just like, wow. But, you know, actually a trans person is the best person for the role, you know? And so therefore a budget is going to be more expensive to mentor a trans person so they can be in part of the conversation. That's the invisible work, behind the scenes work that I'm proud of, I felt I was never going to budge from that. And it made our jobs a lot harder, no doubt. But I walk away from that being like, if a small independent film could do that, you know, can do that work behind the scenes, like larger studio productions have no excuse.
Definitely. And there is a palpable care to the film. As a viewer, I can attest to that. And while people may think, as you mentioned, that trans visibility is a recent event within the past 6 to 10 years, your movie clearly delves into that. It goes way back as early, you know, as early as footage, as they say. And it goes throughout all of the history to today. And of course, all the unseen representation of plays and such, where men would cross-dress and things like that, that attribute to the way transgender people are depicted in media, in the arts. So I'm wondering what the process was like for you of collecting all these scenes to feature in the documentary, because it's kind of like going through historical archives to track through a lot of these things, to cover so much film history.
It was invigorating. You know, it was a lot of work. I love doing research. I love doing archival research. I actually got my start, you know, in the early 2000s working on other people's films, doing archival research. I'm not a trained archivist, but, you know, just on the job, learned how to do it. And I just, you know, collecting it, searching for things, and then organizing it and looking at the patterns, I just find endlessly fascinating. You know, collecting the material took years and years and years. You know, the two films that I referenced earlier, Ethnic Notions of Celluloid Closet, which were big inspirations for this, were based on books. And, you know, when I first thought, okay, I'm going to make this film, I thought there'd be a book on it. There's not. And so that was daunting, not only because I knew it was going to take a lot of work, but also it's like really ethically precarious to document history. You know, so from the beginning, the research was based in conversations that I had with as many trans people at the time that I could get in touch with, who had worked on one side of the camera or the other, and like collecting their memories and their perspectives and, you know, the scenes and the stories that they recall. And so I created this database based on those conversations, and then we'll find an article here or there. And the way I was approaching this idea of transness, because language changes, you know, the way we identify changes, the way society sees us and frames us changes. You know, we know trans people have been a part of every society, part of the fabric of every culture for all time. Language, again, language and context changes. So, like, I wanted to look at how representation had informed how non-trans people understand us and how we see ourselves. So I was like, okay, what characters do we see transgressing gender, right? Because that, like what you were saying earlier, that is going to make a connection to how people understand us and how we see ourselves. So collecting this information and seeing clips going back to 1898, actually. So it was a lot, and figuring out how to tell the story was exhilarating and challenging. A lot of these clips were painful, though not surprising, but there was also this validation that came along with collecting this material of, you know, seeing the roots of the shame and the violence, you know, that I personally had, you know, internalized for so long, and be able to say, okay, these are the roots. You know, it's a bummer that we have to have proof to our feelings, you know, but so often marginalized people are told that they're too sensitive, you know, that they're imagining things in the world, you know, that their experiences aren't valid. And here I was like, okay, I can point to something. And this is something that other people can point to now to say, okay, you can see the roots in this one aspect of our culture to transphobia that we experience now.
Do you feel like a lot of people in the trans community, and I think this extends to the LGBTQ plus community as well, have to naturally become historians in a way? And your personal work has dived into history, and especially with this project. But when there's so little accurate representation, is knowing your history and, you know, proof of feeling, as you mentioned, also a form of self-advocacy? How do you see it?
Yeah, I mean, of course it's empowering. I'm stuck on saying, you said, do we have to? No, I don't think the onus should ever be on the marginalized person to have to. You know, there's a sort of, Laverne's often asked, like, when will she feel like she has succeeded? And she said, well, when not every trans person has to be political, right? When she's not the only trans person that's getting, you know, the bulk of attention. So it empowers people to know their history, no doubt. And it's a real disservice that the onus is on us to find our own history. Like, why isn't it taught in schools? Like, why don't our cultural institutions include us in history? You know, I've heard people talk about how disclosure is a film history in itself. And I agree, right? Like, this can be taught in film history class as a history of film, right? Not simply a history of trans representation.
Definitely. And one big lesson of this film is how to look at and even love things critically. So what did that mean for you in shaping how this documentary was made?
It was really important not ever demonize any person, right? So first off, never blaming an actor. Like, I'm never going to blame anyone for a role. Everyone needs a job. Everyone needs to pay their rent. We're building their careers. And then when, you know, calling to task, you know, writers and filmmakers and directors and pointing out less than flattering storylines, you know, it felt really important to me, again, to not demonize anyone, but to believe that people don't know what they don't know, and that there needs to be a conversation around these issues, around accountability, held with love, you know, delivered with love and context, right? So it's like, we see how with Halle Berry saying she was going to take on this trans story, and she was really excited to tell this woman's story, and it was a trans man's story. Like, it was so complicated and a bummer. And she, you know, it was just like, okay, she really doesn't know what she doesn't know. And disclosure was able to be used with her team to say, hey, like, maybe reconsider taking on this role. So, you know, cancel culture has kind of become this hot button for just, you know, wiping people off the face of conversation. And I, you know, there are some people who probably need to take a step back. But I think it's much more beneficial for all of us to have, you know, this accountability culture, this consequence culture, this opportunity to learn and do better. And we say that again and again in the film, that we just want to do better. And so how do we have these conversations to move us forward?
Also, I think that's noted in the film as you feature different trans activists and artists, is that it's important to show people that there's no one authority on trans representation or experience. You know, some films for some of your guests were positive representation and others were traumatic and triggering.
Yeah. And I love that. I really love that. That kind of speaks back to sort of the history of trans stories, is they're often, and this is documentaries and non-documentaries and independent and Hollywood stuff, but they're often just these singular narratives, you know, that give this false understanding that there is one way to be trans, right? And that there is one way to treat a trans person. And so it was so important to include as many voices to show all the different experiences. And also, we can have a love-hate relationship with this material, and it's okay. You know, and I think that was part of what I also wanted a non-trans audience to experience. Like, this is, there's so much nostalgia in watching these clips. And so how can we love it, but love it with accountability, like love it with a nuance and context, and love it with a media literate understanding, right? How do we cultivate more of an active audience viewing experience and less of a passive acceptance of what we see?
Sam Fader is the director of the documentary Disclosure, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski last August. The film is available to stream on Netflix, and you can hear their full conversation at WUWM.com. And that is today's Lake Effect. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, you can find them all at WUWM.com. And you can always take us on the go as a podcast. Search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or really wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to hear our favorite interviews from the week, look for Lake Effect Spotlight. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn about Wisconsin's complicated history with women's suffrage and how the state helped in the fight for women's right to vote. Plus, we'll learn about the Wisconsin man who created SpaghettiOs and how he helped pave the way for other shelf-stable foods. That's tomorrow at 10 on Lake Effect, here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.